Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to All Stats On. We are podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings-on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm John McKenzie, the Yes, Own Goals is back of the podcast. Where have you been, old friend? And I'm joined by the Luke Ayling, deep in his own goal of the podcast, Darren Driver. What is he doing there? And finally, the Joffrey Gellhart of the podcast, always there and thereabouts, but having not made his first team debut yet, it's Simon Tinsley. Simon, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well, thanks. I think that's the kindest third spot intro you've done, so feeling honoured.
We had to make sure we got the dig in at Darren, of course, but I figured with you being a debutant, we had to do you last, but I wasn't gonna hammer you. So unfortunately, Darren drew this short straw again. But thank you so much for coming on at such short notice. It's great to have someone on who is a different voice, and also someone who's going to say something a bit more positive about Diego Llorente for a change. So thank you for coming on.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
And Darren Driver, how are you?
Yeah, I'm okay, thanks. I was going to demand the steward's inquiry for, you know, still getting pelters in the middle position, but as you quite rightly point out, it's not really fair to hammer Simon. So yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. I enjoyed this morning over my breakfast. I really enjoyed watching the highlights of West Brom Chelsea yesterday. Not because I've got any particular beef with this Chelsea team, but I always like it when financially doped sides look stupid. So I very, very much enjoyed that this morning.
Well, let's just dig in with the review from yesterday, a 2-1 win over Sheffield United at Elland Road. And I'll start in time-honoured fashion by saying, how did that feel? And I'll go with you, Darren. How did that feel yesterday?
Do you know, it was a bit frustrating all told, because I felt like From minute one, we were clearly superior to Sheffield United in ways that we weren't, you know, like in the reverse fixture. It was a much tighter, much closer game, which could really have gone either way. But I really feel like we kind of failed to make that superiority count, and that we got into loads and loads of really good positions, loads of dangerous areas. But like I just felt like our decision making was really poor throughout the kind of the game, really. So we ended up with feeling like we dominated an entire game, but with hardly any true goal scoring opportunities to look, you know, to kind of show for it. So yeah, all told, I was a bit frustrated, and I was even more frustrated because I'd spent 2 weeks looking forward to it, because I studiously ignore international football to, you know, to the kind of point of stubbornness. So I'd kind of built myself up to really enjoy this game, and like in the first 10 minutes I thought, yeah, we're just going to absolutely smash these off the park and it's going to be really good fun. And then it turned out to be not quite as much fun as I hoped it would be.
Simon, how about you? How did you feel about the game?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. It probably felt more nervy than it should have done. For the level of domination we had, it felt like a little bit of a throwback to a championship game where we dominated the other team, but the scoreline didn't reflect it, and therefore you were kind of unnecessarily sweating about the result come the last like 10 minutes or so. But overall, I mean, I watched the extended highlights back this morning, and it was more comfortable than I remember at the time.
Yeah, I was looking at the XG on StatsBomb on FB Ref this morning, and I think it was 2.5-1 in our favour, obviously. So we definitely created enough to win, I think. There's no doubt about that. And let's not forget that the own goal was obviously not credited in the XG as well. Make of that what you will.
0.7 of theirs was just their goal. which would have been a lot less if they didn't get the deflection as well. So they didn't really create anything else.
Yeah. Interesting to see you say that it felt like a championship game, because I think the big game for us this season, really, in terms of what we wanted to see, was the Crystal Palace game, where we just controlled that game. And I think for me, the big question I have is how is it that we can control a game like that against Palace, but don't control a game against Sheffield United, who I think, you know, again, neither of those teams are particularly impressive, but it does feel as though this season has been sort of frenetic. In some games we can control games, in other games we can sort of lose control a little bit. And I wondered, Simon, what you made of that. What do you think it is about this Leeds team that makes them so hard to read on a sort of weekly basis?
I think we struggle with any teams that when they press us. I think Crystal Palace didn't press us at all. I think Sheffield United didn't press us that much, but the times when it looked a little bit frenetic were when they tried to apply pressure to our backline. I thought we gave the ball away quite a lot, like Darren said, quite sloppily, which doesn't help. I also think we probably take more risks in an attacking sense than we did in Championship. I think Rafinha and, well, Rodrigo wasn't playing, but when he does, and I think Roberts as well to some extent, will go for the high risk, high reward pass quite often. I think that can often show up as a lack of control, even though it can generate good opportunities.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think quite often Rafinha will try the most difficult thing possible before we've got any security in our possession at all. And I think that that means that we look bad in transition. And I thought that there were times when he looked amazing yesterday, and there were other times when I was absolutely doing my editing because he was just completely kind of looking for the most speculative thing possible, and really putting us under quite a lot of pressure. That their goal being a really good example of that, which came from him doing exactly that.
Yeah, I don't want to dig too deep into this because we've got a few questions about the loss of possession and control, which we'll get to in a bit. So let's move on to the general questions. Again, thank you for all of your questions. We had too many to fit all of them in, so bear with us. We've picked out the representative ones that cover the most subjects that we need to cover. So first question, which we had a couple of questions like this actually from Jip. Were there signs of complacency today? Felt that other times of the season we would have steamrolled a team like that. And Darren, what did you make of that?
I didn't read it as complacency. I just read it as occasionally we struggle when we kind of get pressed in a mid block, which is the only time that they were really pressing yesterday, was when the ball was going into our midfield and particularly in wide areas, and that meant that it looked like there were plenty of times when we had lots of time on the ball, and but you know, in our back third and in their final third, that was true. But we did struggle at times to kind of get the ball through the kind of middle third as much as we might like, and I think that maybe why it looked a bit like complacency. I also think, and I touched on it just a minute ago, that I think perhaps, I wouldn't say Rafinha has been complacent, but I think some of the things that he was doing spoke to maybe a slight overconfidence or a slight kind of, a will to look like the best player on the park, whereas if he'd have just played more of his natural game, he would have been that anyway, in any case. So I think if there was any complacency, that's where it came from, but I'd say overconfidence more than anything.
I think the thing that I took from the game yesterday was just how weak Sheffield United were in their own final third. And I think when you're in that scenario where it's looking a little bit more open in the middle third, and the opposition looking really weak in the final third, you feel as though you should be hammering a team. And I think we got into scenarios where, I mean, especially in the second half when we had a number of attacking transitions that looked ridiculously dangerous, ending in nothing at all, then I think it's really hard to sort of judge what's going on. Simon, how are you on the complacency side of things?
Yeah, I think I agree with Darren. I think if you put another of the good opportunities in the net and you win 4-1, no one calls it complacent. I think it's partly a reflection on the scoreline. I agree with the point about Rafinha. I think it felt a bit like he was playing against the under-23s, and I think he probably felt a little bit like that, felt like he could do anything. Sometimes the simple ball would have been more helpful, but I'm obviously very loath to criticise Rafinha for obvious reasons.
Let's talk a little bit about the formation then, the general structure, because there was a long discussion in the question thread about formation, with people suggesting we could maybe have played a back four, maybe played a back three. What formation were we playing, particularly at the back? Darren, I'll get to you on this one. What did you make of the structure?
So it looked to me that when Sheffield United had the ball in their back third, we were playing something that looked a bit like a 3-5-2. I think as they progressed up the pitch, we moved to something which looked more like a 3-3-3-1 or a 3-3-1-3. When we were in possession, our two centre-backs were forming a pair and then we were kind of going to that 2-3-5 type build-up formation that we see us use at times. And in attack, it looked very much as you would not normally expect to see. I think the variations to do with our defensive formation were purely to do with Sheffield United's 3-5-2 and trying to match it up and make sure that we press their centre backs well, which I thought we did by and large, particularly in the first half. And then making sure that, you know, that we kind of got that we followed our men quite diligently. And you know, Simon's right, they really didn't create anything except the goal. I thought defensively we looked pretty solid in those formations.
And I think we spent a lot of time in the preview. When I say we spent a lot of time, we spent a lot of the time that we spent previewing Sheffield United.
Three of the 5 minutes.
Yeah, we spent a lot of that time talking about whether or not you play Luke Ayling in that back three. It transpired that that's what he did, and we did make a point of the fact that if you play Ayling as a right-sided centre-back in that back three, he has license to get forward a little bit more. And so in possession, we very quickly looked like we were moved into that sort of back four with Calvin Phillips sitting in the middle of it. Mike Turetsky had a question saying, hi guys, what do you think? Why do you think Bielsa opted for Ayling as a third centre-back and not Cork or Pascal? Simon, what did you make of that?
There's probably two reasons. I think if you play Ayling as your third centre-back, you have quite a lot more flexibility in-game. So if Sheffield United move to one striker at any point, you don't have to change the personnel. You can just shuffle the positions. I think the other thing is, I think Ayling's probably our best ball progressor in the back line. And I think having him either as the right back or as the right centre back, it gives you more in build-up than either Robin Koch or Pascal Strike would be my kind of why I would have opted. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We had a question from Will as well saying, do we agree with Liam Cooper coming back into the team? Which I don't think any of us will necessarily disagree with. Liam Cooper is the club captain. He's also, I think, probably, and I mean, it's very hard to talk about defensive stats because it's very hard to measure what centre-backs do well using data. But on all of the useful data that we have, Liam Cooper has probably been our best centre-back this season as well. So it, despite the fact that I think all of us as well, and I'm talking for the two of you, so I'll move over to let you have your say, but I think for all of us, Pascal Strike's had an absolutely amazing breakout season, but you don't have amazing breakout seasons and knock the club captain off his perch when he's playing the best football he's probably played in his career. So Simon, I'll get to you on this. Do you agree with Cooper coming back into the team?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the logical decision. I think as much as I love Pascal Strike and would like to see him play every game, I think that's my emotions overriding my brain.
What about you, Darren?
I know that Cooper still has his quite vehement critics, but to me it's clear that we do look more solid when Cooper's in the team. I think, and I also think if you're up against the sort of striker that McBurnie is, and then Cooper's spent his career dealing with that sort of striker, the kind of, you know, who's effectively a championship level player. And I agree with Simon, you know, like I absolutely love Pascal Strauch, and I've said that, you know, spoken about that many times on this podcast. But at the moment, his second choice to Cooper in that position, and if Cooper's fit, he's going to start, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's not going to harm Strauch's development to be the backup to Cooper for now, and he will get his chance, and when he does, he'll take it. But for now, Cooper is, you know, as you quite rightly said, all the statistics show him being one of the most effective central defenders in the division, so he's got to be. He is, and quite rightly, the first choice for that position.
I feel as though I should say at this point, in my day job, I work for Analytics FC, who are a football data company who basically run a model which allows them to build a scouting tool, essentially. But I have access to that model as part of my job. And one of the interesting things for me is that this whole model is built on what's often called a sort of possession value model, which is sounds
horrendously complex, but isn't really. But it's not even technically a possession value model. I'm told it's based on what's called the Markov chain model. And essentially, what this model does is it takes all of the events in a game, and it tries to give the events value above. You know, in the same way that XG tries to give value to chances, it's trying to do that for every different type of event on the pitch. And so when I put Liam Cooper through that model, he shows up really, really well in terms of the value that he adds to Leeds United. And even interestingly, in terms of his progressive passing, both he and Diego Llorente, who we all agree is a very good progressive passer, they have very, very similar numbers as well this season. So I think a lot of people are underrating just quite how good Liam Cooper is. And I think on that basis, it's just very, very hard to argue that he shouldn't be playing if he's fit. Let's move on and talk a little bit. So we've got a few more general questions. Callum MCC said, how did the midfield perform defensively? I felt like we defended poorly, but I also thought Llorente and Cooper had mostly good games. I'll go to you on this, Simon. What's your sort of gut take on this?
Yeah, I saw that question, and it's not something I noticed when I was watching the game. I thought the midfield was mostly fine. I think generally the team structurally defensively was pretty good, and it was shown in Sheffield United not creating much. I agree that Llorente and Cooper had good games as well.
I was sort of that way as well. I felt as though maybe the issues were more transitional, but I know, Darren, you've got some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I agree. I thought we defended, you know, mostly fine, but when we were bad in transition, that opens the entire team up and puts us under a lot of unnecessary pressure, and I thought we did that repeatedly yesterday. So yeah, I think when Sheffield United managed to move the ball through the thirds, we didn't look like we were in any danger whatsoever, and they didn't really create anything at all. Anything that they did manage to create, we were kind of our own worst enemy in that sense, giving the ball away when we're not in decent position to mop it up.
It does feel a little bit sometimes as though in games like that, we're always sort of treading a little bit of a fine line. And I guess this comes back to your comment, Simon, about how it felt like a championship game. And it felt to me in a lot of those games where, unless we were a couple of goals clear, you were always just a complete oppositional fluke away from, you know, conceding and the giving up points. And I felt a little bit like that yesterday. I felt as though, you know, they were going to just luck out a set piece somewhere and maybe put us under pressure. Although obviously in the event it didn't actually, I thought their set pieces were remarkably poor. Actually, we got quite a lot of transitions ourselves out of that. But again, I suppose this comes back to what I was talking about before with the maybe feeling a little bit confused as to why we can't control games against teams like Sheffield United, and it just being so hard to judge how Leeds will do in certain games. I think a lot of people thought we were going to go into this game and just comfortably roll Sheffield United over in a way that we have done with, for example, Newcastle. And in both games against them, they've been tough to break down, and they haven't looked like the worst team in the division per our playing against them. So I don't know really where I'm going with this, but
Yeah, but I mean, Sheffield United haven't lost heavily that many times, have they? I mean, I know they got turned over for five by Leicester, but generally their games over the course of the season, although they've lost the majority of them, have been pretty tight. And you know, I think that must be something in Sheffield United's style which kind of contributes to that.
Do we read into it though? Then do we look forward to next season and think there are certain, you know, there's a sort of general assumption, I think, amongst the fan base that we're as good as our best results, and our poorer results are just not really indicative of anything. It's just a sort of bad day at the office. I don't know, again, that this is just anecdotal and stuff, but I wondered if you would read into that in any way.
It's an interesting one, that, because I sort of think that there's a very real possibility that next season we improve our worst results, i.e. we don't lose 6-2 at Old Trafford, we lose 1-0 or 2-0, and then there's a tangible improvement. But actually that doesn't improve the season as a whole at all, does it? Because we'll still end up, I think, broadly in the same or slightly improved position next season. So yeah, I think that, yeah, it's a really interesting question, and maybe probably one for another day. But it's, yeah, I think we if we can improve our worst results and our worst performances and sort of make sure that we are able to control games in ways that we did in the Championship, but that by and large we haven't been able to do in the Premier League, that games might become a more comfortable and more predictable experience than the kind of wild variation in results and performances that we've seen across the course of this season.
I think if you take a look at some of our worst results, there's some clear weaknesses, and teams that exploit them well have shown us up, particularly I'm thinking getting pressed in wide areas here. And so if you do make a couple of improvements, and especially at left back, where Alioski, his particular weakness is build up under pressure, probably the least press resistant player I've seen in a long time.
Ever.
Yeah, potentially. What you do is you reduce the number of weaknesses that other teams can exploit, and that will, you'll not lose 6-2, and you may lose 1-0, but you also increase your chances of getting a result, and that will show up over the 38 games.
Yeah, Alioski struggles to break his own press sometimes, I think, which is a remarkable turn of events. LUFC Josh says, first 20 minutes of the second half was sensational. The last 25, it felt like something changed. What did we do differently, or what did Sheffield change to cause this? Simon?
Like Darren's put in the note, Bamford coming off, and we've seen it time and time again. He's so crucial to the press from the front, and we often lose control when he's off the pitch.
Yeah, we went to kind of more of a mid block until Click came on, didn't we? I thought it was quite noticeable that we weren't really pressing at all at that point, and it again meant that not only were we putting ourselves under unnecessary pressure, but that we weren't able to create the sort of chances from pressing that we ordinarily do either.
Let's go to the question on Rodrigo here, because I think a lot of this does come down to him. So Kia Milburn says, any sign of improvement in Rodrigo's pressing and positional play? We seemed a lot easier to play through in the first 10 minutes after Bamford came off, but perhaps the high press was abandoned due to match day. And that's what you're talking about there, Darren, that we did sit in a bit more of a mid-blocky kind of thing, which is really weird to see. One thing to say is that Jamie Kemp over on LUFC blog put up a graphic showing the high press turnovers that we had this game, and it was the highest game in terms of high press turnovers for us, and clearly that dropped off after the 70 minutes. So I think that made it even more noticeable that we moved from a scenario where we were pressing high and doing really well in the first half and in the first part of the second half, and then that suddenly dropped off as soon as Bamford came off. But I'll put this over to you, Simon, because we've talked a lot about how Rodrigo's pressing is not good enough, and it would be nice to have a neutral opinion on this. What's your sort of take on the whole, what does the future of Rodrigo look like if he can't get the pressing sorted out?
Yeah, I was having a look at it because I was trying to see whether my eyes were fooling me, and so I tried to look at some of the data, and I was quite surprised that Roberts and Rodrigo essentially have similar numbers of pressures per 90 and similar numbers of successful pressures. So that's when the team regains the ball within 5 seconds of the pressure, and that kind of suggests to me that it's not like he's pressing out of time. The other thing that does stand out from data is he is just an awful tackler. Whenever anyone tries to dribble past him, they usually manage to achieve it. And so, and this is contrary to what I thought before. I thought before Rodrigo just needed a bit more time to learn the system, whereas I think actually it may be a like technical tackling deficiency that's causing him to look kind of out of place in the press. And then obviously that disrupts the whole of the man marking system as soon as you have one player dribble past.
Yeah, this is something that actually we've come up against a few times. There's been a few times where we've been critical of Rodrigo's pressing, and people have then gone to the FB ref data and they've said, but actually, if you look at his pressing, he's pretty much comparable to Tyler Roberts, as you've said, as he was yesterday. And also, he has quite a good success rate. And I think having done that a few times and having then gone back and rewatched the game and I tested it, I think he largely is like a... He largely is an okay presser insofar as he does get to players. He does put them under pressure. But also, I think, like you said, there is a technical deficiency there. He's actually often played past in the press. And then you'll see often, because of that 5 seconds leeway with the successful pressures, because Leeds are so high pressure, someone may win it back in the next pressure, and so that stacks up as a positive pressure for him as well. Now, obviously, that's just me doing eye test on a few of these matches, but I do think there's something in that. I think that we can talk all we like about successful pressures, and I think most of the Leeds team do show up quite well in terms of pressures for this reason. But I do think there are, like you say, technical deficiencies where he'll often press from behind the player, and I think it will count as a pressure. But he's still allowing that player to play the ball down the field into the feet of other players as well. But Darren, what's your take on this?
Yeah, absolutely the same, really, because yeah, the numbers do show one thing, but clearly whenever he's on the pitch, really, we do struggle to win the ball high up, and that sort of clear gaps start to appear, which opposition are often really able to exploit. Or like yesterday, we end up completely really abandoning the thing which has got us the most success during the game, which really made that last 25 minutes much more difficult than it necessarily needed to be, because I really felt the entire way through that Sheffield United were really there for the taking, and all we needed to do was kind of really maintain an intensity and a pressure, and that eventually they would gift us a goal, much like Fulham were, you know, Fulham did, because they weren't able to get through our press when we applied it. So yeah, I know that we've been quite critical of Rodrigo and everything, and I don't like feeling like that about players, because I actually do genuinely think he's a really, really good player. I think he would have been much better at Everton or Leicester or Villa, or, you know, one of those teams that don't necessarily do as much or high press with as much consistency or intensity, and then you can, you know, kind of uses on the ball stuff much more effectively. But I just think he's the wrong fit for this team, and I hope that I'm wrong, and I hope that he improves next season, but I just don't think that the evidence of the matches that he's played in stack up to that.
It does seem like a transfer that had sort of a high likelihood of not working, given that he'd never really played sort of high pressing football. He was 29, nearly 30 when we brought him in. He was quite expensive as well, so I think a lot of our criticism comes from that sort of perspective, that we've now basically lumbered our squad with a player who you sort of feel obliged to play, who's presumably taking a fairly big wage packet as well, and so in that sense it's sort of hard to justify it.
And like this season, if he's still around next season, there will be, you know, 5 to 8, maybe 10 games where he looks really good, and then the rest where he's much more difficult to kind of fit in or to make a case for him for having a place in the starting 11. So yeah, I don't know, we'll see.
It's worth adding that his in attack he's been very, very good. His numbers are excellent all around in terms of creation, getting on the end of chances, ball progression and so on. I think the question is it worth absorbing his lack of pressing for the upside that you get in the attacking sense or not, and that would require a change in the midfield.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he's very creative, but two, I think he's creative in a different way to Click. I think Click's maybe more of a volume creation player, whereas with Rodrigo, I think it feels a little bit more, and a lot of the data stacks up on this as well, actually, the chances that he creates are more dangerous. And yeah, the none of us would argue that he isn't probably our most you just have to look at his pedigree, right? There's a reason why he's played Champions League football for so long. There's a reason why he's played international football for so long. But yeah, it is just a question of how do you make him work in this team, and it doesn't feel as though we've really quite got the hang of how we do that. Still got questions about the game, actually, in terms of what was going on the pitch. So Jack Champion said, are we seeing Phillips pushing higher up to win possession back? Might be after watching Rafa's goal at Fulham or watching him play as an 8 for England, but it feels like we're seeing a few chances recently created from a KP pressure in the final third. I mean, obviously one of those Fulham goals was created by a KP pressure in the final third. I don't know what I think on this. I feel as though, you know, there's a certain level of stricture because you have to follow the man that you're marking. So however high up the field Phillips is usually dependent on however high up his marking responsibility is up the field. And I think was he marking Lundstrom yesterday? I can't remember. I think that was the one where he turned the ball over, where he dropped really high, picked the ball up off quite a sloppy touch from Lundstrom, and then had that shot down to Ramsdale's right-hand side when Ramsdale was sort of in the build-up play in a bit out of position. But yeah, I'll put this over to you, Simon. Let's start with you. What do you think we're seeing Phillips pushing higher up? Is it just a case that, you know, he was following players who ended up dropping deeper?
I think it's more the latter. I think Sheffield United play without a true 10, and so his starting position was just quite a lot higher than normally is. I don't think there's anything kind of wider going on. I haven't been looking out for it. I'll keep an eye on it in future games, but I haven't noticed it before today.
I think when he plays in the midfield, when we play a back three, his starting position tends to be a little bit higher than it would in the four anyway. So I think that probably contributes a little bit to it.
Yep.
One final question on the sort of match state was from Yudav Chauhan, who said, were defensive duties the reason behind Harrison and Rafinha swapping wings? So Darren, what did you make of that?
I thought that throughout the game, our right winger, and I say that advisedly because Harrison actually played as part of the two for quite a lot of the first half, but the person on the right tended to sit deeper and tended to be the person who was the first pass in transition. And as we saw repeatedly in the first half, Rafinha gave it away too often or tried things that were a bit too speculative too often. And I thought Harrison was just a bit more solid and diligent when he dropped in there in the second half, which is, you know, kind of a reasonably good description of Harrison at the best of times, isn't it? So I thought that it meant that we could try and get Rafinha higher up the pitch and try hit him sooner. I don't think that really worked out, and I thought it was one of those games where Rafinha looks worse on the left than he does on the right. But I think that's mostly because he very much had the beating of his opposition number when he was playing on the right and was able to kind of get past him quite a few times, and that opens things up, doesn't it?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's move on and talk about Stuart Dallas, who I think actually was probably my man of the match yesterday. I thought he was really good, both in terms of just his energy, but also I thought he largely contributed quite well in transitioning the ball forward as well. Again, I didn't think that Sheffield United were up to much in the central midfield area, which probably contributed to it. But we had a few questions about Dallas next season. So Mike Turetsky says, all the talk is of getting a new left back and centre midfield, and those are primarily Dallas's positions, but surely our possible player of the season is now an integral player in the starting 11 for next season. Is Dallas undroppable? And Chris Kirk says, is Dallas a genuine option now for at eight for next season? So let's start with you, Darren. What's your take on this?
Oh, thanks, you've thrown me a right hospital pass, haven't you? Well, clearly Dallas has been our best performer for the last couple of months, and he's been an absolutely integral cog in the team. And again, he was very good yesterday for all the reasons that we've talked about many times: his energy, his decision making, his ability to kind of hold decent positions, and all of those things. You know, I absolutely wouldn't take away from him. Whether he's a genuine option for eight next season, what I would say is that we will bring someone in next season, I think, and Dallas's job will be to persuade Bielsa that he deserves the shirt more than the new signing, and whether he's capable of doing that, I don't know. I think if we're going to start to look for the sort of control that we had at times in the Championship, when we had Click, Forshaw, Phillips and Pablo all playing together and basically the opposition couldn't get the ball, I don't think Dallas is going to be the man that is able to play in that sort of system. And I think that might be the thing which sees him drop out. But if next season we go into it and we're still kind of playing quite transitionally and we're still trying to create chaos like we do at times, and I think he's still a really good option there. But I think Bielsa will be looking for more control, and Dallas's role in the team will probably slip back a little bit as a result of that.
I agree. I think it's no secret Dallas has been excellent this year. I think he was excellent again yesterday, particularly as his counter-pressing was superb as well. I think in terms of squad construction, Dallas is 29 now, and so we do need to be kind of like have half an eye on replacing Dallas just in terms of age curves. And I think even though I agree with Darren's assessment that he probably won't start the season as first choice, but he will be first change at both left back and central midfield. So I'd still expect him to get a lot of minutes. And if he performs well, we know Bielsa will keep you in the team if you're playing well and you've got the shirt.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And I think one of the points that I've made a few times on this podcast is that Dallas is playing well because we've basically created a position for him to solve a problem that we have, and he's been absolutely excellent at doing that. But as you mentioned there, Darren, it's not the ideal world, I don't think, for Bielsa. I don't think Bielsa ideally wants to have a player who's essentially zonally marking a lot of the time when the opposition have the ball in his central midfield. I think he wants a little bit more of a higher press, probably, but we can't afford to do that with the squad that we have at the moment. So it's really going to be fascinating, I think next season, over the summer, really seeing who we bring in, whether or not we bring in someone who is, you know, a sort of high energy attacking player who can do that that sort of work. Cough, cough, Emi Buendia. That just makes me sad that we won't see Emi Buendia. But someone like Buendia who would solve all of the problems that we have, hopefully we'll get someone like that. And I think if you do that, then you start raising questions about, you know, what the ideal 11 then starts looking like. It probably looks a little bit different. But that's obviously no slight on Stuart Dallas, who's been fantastic this season. And yeah, it's just the way that football goes, I'm afraid. It's, you can have a player playing fantastic one season, and then the squad composition changes the next, and you can have casualties to that. But I think he'll definitely be around. He'll see out his career, probably, or at least the next chunk of his career, before maybe moving on somewhere else at Leeds. And I think Leeds will be the better side for it. It's just incredible having a player who is that flexible. You can basically make him do anything and know that he's going to do the job well, both in terms of his performance, but also tactically as well. He's a really smart player, and it's been great watching him this season. And I'm happy to eat my hat on that one, because I didn't think that he would ever be as good as he's been this season. So I'm happy to take the L on that one. Let's talk about Rafinha. We've already talked a lot about losses of possession, and maybe Rafinha being a little bit too flamboyant in possession. So Richard Lang says, Rafinha at the core of our creativity again, however, is the team's view that he was guilty of losing the ball too often today, where an easier ball seemed the better option. Jamie Smith says, who gives the ball away more per 90, Rafinha or Roberts? Rafinha loses possession a lot, but gets nowhere near the amount of stick that Roberts does. For the record, I don't mind either of them losing the ball. Attacking players are supposed to take risks. And then Brolin Ate the Pie says, many comments on here regarding a loss of possession. All Stats On, we have discussed this as a function of the attacking strategy deployed by Bielsa. So is there data that supports the contention better players in attacking transitions lose possession less? All Stats On, we have suggested this may be so. I think just to colour that question at the end, I think the suggestion is that when we bring in better players, we will retain the ball in possession more in attacking transition. And I think we've said that a few times on this podcast. I'll go to you, Darren, first on this. What's your take on, let's not talk about Rafinha in general, I think, because we've covered that, but let's talk a little bit more about this idea that you sort of have a certain amount of lenience with players, in a particularly attacking creative players, losing possession. What do you make of that?
I think that there are certain phases of play where it's perfectly acceptable to kind of go, well, yeah, an attacking player is going to try something speculative, they're going to try something difficult, and it may or may not come off. I think the problem yesterday was that there were times when we weren't doing that, when the phase of play in which people were trying to do the more speculative or difficult or creative things was before the team had kind of got any sort of positional solidity, so that we were ready to catch any counters if they came. For me, any attacking player, and you know, we used to see this all the time in the Championship. If Pablo gave the ball away a lot in the final third, you know, the mentions were being undated with, oh, Pablo's broken, Pablo's passed it, Pablo's gone, yada, yada, yada. When actually Pablo gave the ball away a lot in every game. And generally those, but the thing that he would do is he would try and do it in areas where it wasn't necessarily going to cause us a lot of harm. And I think that perhaps better decision-making is what you get, rather than better technical skill with the really elite players that we need to be looking to bring in next season.
Simon, you'll definitely have an opinion on this. What do you make of this question?
I agree with Darren. I think the better your players are, the more completion you're going to get for any level of risk. And so if you have better players, you could lose possession less, or you could take more risks. and generate more attack. And so you just kind of, you moved yourself up the trade-off. I think Rafinha is a very direct player, which I think is part of his strength, but also does mean that we have issues in transition. I think he's very, very good in open space. And I think it's often to his our credit that we kind of let him loose on that rather than and sacrifice a bit of control as a result. I think the question about Rafinha and Roberts is interesting because I think I haven't looked at the data. I imagine it's probably right they give the ball away similar amounts. I think the reason Rafinha doesn't get the amount of stick, although partly because Robert gets a lot of unfair stick, but partly because Rafinha does generate more attack as a result of for the same kind of cost. And you've got to look at both sides of the equation.
Yeah, I also wonder how much the fact that we play man marking comes into this as well. And I think, you know, we've already talked about how Rafinha was giving the ball away quite deep yesterday because he was playing on that right hand wing back role for the first part of the game, and he was losing the ball in those dangerous areas. And I think that, you know, the part of the reason was just so that when Rafinha did lose the ball, he was just losing it further up the field. I also think that these mistakes become so much more obvious when you play a man-marking system. So, for example, their goal came from Rafinha losing the ball and then us being in a defensive transition where we just looked a complete mess, really, in terms of the man-marking structure as well. So I think there's maybe an argument to be made that a team like Leeds has to be hyper-aware of players like that or manage them well. And I guess that's what that switch from left to right, or right to left, sorry, was about yesterday. I also think it's worth saying that, you know, players like Kevin De Bruyne are similar. If you look at Kevin De Bruyne's stats, he is turning the ball over a lot because he is trying those creative things. And I think Rafinha is a better player than Roberts. No one's arguing otherwise. So Rafinha does get, you know, he does get away with a lot more because I think he also creates, as you said, Simon, a lot more as well. And it's, I think with Rafinha as well, how many goals do we create that we wouldn't have created if Rafinha wasn't on the pitch? Yesterday's Harrison goal was all about Rafinha. I mean, Roberts did the pre-assists on both the goals yesterday, it should also be said. And Roberts' ball to Rafinha was obviously good for the Harrison goal, but, you know, there was a difference between what those two players did. And the level that Rafinha is at is just incredible. I think there's so many instances where you see him just making incredible decisions on the ball. He just puts the ball in the right space between defenders. Even yesterday, he breezes through that defensive line to hit the byline so easily. The goal against Fulham, again, is a goal where I think most players, if they were presented with a ball that Bamford put in for Rafinha, don't score that because it was just too close to the centre-back. And Bamford actually said in the post-match interview, I put it closer to the defender because I knew that Rafinha would either, you know, get the ball through or win a penalty. And that's the difference between Roberts and Rafinha is I don't think his teammates aren't making those sorts of passes thinking this is Roberts. He's definitely going to be able to create a chance out of nothing here. It's just the way that it is. So, but I do think I agree with you, Simon, that Roberts is getting unfairly maligned. So maybe we should talk a little bit about Roberts now, because we had a few questions about Roberts. Mark Dennett said, well, I'm happy to eat my words on Roberts, but how many chances did he create today? He was great. Chris Wolford said, thoughts on Roberts? Thought he was excellent today and one of our best creative outlets. Seems to be a confidence player. Best game in a Leeds shirt? And should he now start consistently over our other options in that role? Old Thorntonian says, Roberts on the cusp of a true breakout game. How many will he inspire us to beat Man City third 11 by next week? Let's go to you, Simon, on this, because I'm always interested to hear a voice that I haven't heard on a player that we've talked about a lot on this podcast. So what do you make of Roberts?
The most exciting thing for me is the kind of upward trajectory. You're seeing the clear improvement versus not just earlier this season, but also last season as well. I think he's finally getting a run of games in the team, and you can see that he's kind of in a good rhythm and is like showing a lot of improvements both in his decision making and technically as well. I think at age 22, it's not unsurprising. It's the kind of make or break age, really. You tend to either make a bit of a leap around that kind of 21 to 23 age, or you don't. In the data, it's not particularly impressive in terms of final third output this year. I think he definitely struggled earlier this season. I think he still can improve his decision making in the final third. I think his ball progression, particularly through carrying the ball forward, has been very impressive in recent weeks. So yeah, excited to see where its potential could lie.
Yeah, and I think it's a real checkmark against Bielsa that he is happy to take players and develop them in that way. You know, we've seen that with Pascal Strauch as well. I think no Leeds fan after that Cardiff game last season would ever have really wanted to see Pascal Strauch in a Leeds shirt again. And now he's become probably one of the best young centre-backs in the division just through dint of having the time to develop. And it's just, you know, on the one hand, on this podcast we often say, you don't just throw under 23s into first team football and expect it to work out. But when you do have players who are at the level who can perform, it's a real testament to Bielsa that he does that with players like Strauch and Roberts. And I think if you can't see that trajectory that you've talked about, Simon, with Roberts, then I don't know what to say, because I think it's just been so clear that we've been patient with Roberts and we've seen that genuine uptick in terms of his output. And I think the same is true of Pascal Strauch as well. You know, he's just looked more and more calm and assured. And I think just the idea of playing a game and knowing that you're not going to be dropped off the back of a poor performance is just so important for development. But Darren, have you got any closing thoughts on Tyler Roberts before we move on?
No, just that he's been really good since he came back into the team, and I've been really pleased to see it. I mean, you know, I'm on record as saying before that I'm a big fan of his. I think he's got a much bigger upside than a lot of people seem to think he's got, and just that pass for the own goal yesterday was just absolutely fantastic, and you know, it was one of the moments of real true quality in the game that were largely provided by him and Rafinha. And Roberts, you know, for the last seven or eight games has been involved in everything good that the team's done, so just, you know, more credit to him.
Right, it's that time of the podcast where I'm forced to talk about Llorente and I regret it, and everyone else regrets it, and we all wish it never happened, but here we are. Neil says, is it time for a Llorente apology piece? I noticed on the latest podcast that once again, you don't seem to rate him. Can't think of any serious errors he's made, and he looks very comfortable at the back. Now, I just want to give some caveats, because I think we'll get Simon to talk about Llorente, because Simon is a neutral voice, and I think he's a bit more positive than maybe we've been on Llorente. But I do want to say that there seems to be this idea that there is a general all stats on we attitude on Llorente, and I just want to demystify that a little bit, because I don't think that's true at all. I think there's a spectrum of takes on Llorente from all stats on we, which range from Josh Hobbs, who's, I think, pretty positive about him, all the way through to probably Darren, who is probably the least positive about him. And I think there's reasons for that. You know, Josh Hobbs loves a through ball, and Llorente plays some great through balls. Darren loves
defending.
And I think this question, there are questions to be raised about Llorente's defending. So with that in mind, it almost seems as though after every game we get a question about Llorente, and I don't want to have to talk about Llorente all the time. I think it would just be good to contextualise that our original criticisms, and those original criticisms were my criticisms, so I don't think they should be held against the other guys here. But I watched a lot of his minutes last season for Sociedad. There's certain questions I have about him that I still have about him. I think that where I should maybe hold my hand up is that I think I maybe underrated how good he would be against lower league sides. And I think it's important to note that the games that he's played well in have been against teams like Fulham. We've seen him really good against Southampton as well. And Sheffield United, I think he was fine yesterday as well. So I think maybe I've been too negative on him in how well he would do in those games. But as we've said, you know, there haven't been many games where he's had to do a huge amount in terms of defensive work, particularly with quick players running at him. And I think that will be where we discover just how good or bad he's going to be. But I would say that I do still have a few defensive criticisms of him, and I don't think it's unfair to raise those criticisms. I think he's been pretty good one-on-one. And since the first few games he played, and no doubt that was because his fitness got back, he got a little bit more confidence. But I do think that he is a bit of a positionally weak player at times. So I found a few clips yesterday where his positioning was a little bit poor. And I think this may have been because he was playing in the centre of back three. And I think he would prefer to play as a right centre back in that back three. I think I would prefer to have him there, but obviously if you're going to play Ayling there, then it sort of raises questions about where you fit him in. So they played him in the centre, and I think he needs to have a man marking player against whom he can orientate himself positionally. And in the centre of that back three, he was playing as the libero, the floating player. And at times, I think it means that he almost sort of steps too far back. He hides a little bit from stepping up. There's a few chances I found where players got one-on-one with opponents in front of goal, and he should have been backing up, and he wasn't. I think there's also a case to be made that he should have tried to get something on the ball for their goal as well. But I think he's been largely really good for us this season. And so I'm happy to take the L on maybe being a little bit too down on him against lower table sides. And I think he'll be a really useful player for us, especially in those games where we need someone who has a bit more of a ability to progress the ball from deep. So there's my sermon over. I'll pass you over to Simon, who is now going to tell you all why I'm so wrong on your end.
I think that's mostly fair. I'd probably put a slightly more positive spin on it. I think Llorente is a very active defender. When you look at the numbers, he has, of our central defenders, the most tackles, most interceptions, most pressures, most clearances, which is in part a style thing, and I think in part points to a slight positional weakness, which means that he has to do more defending. I think he probably is a very, very good one-on-one defender, probably our best centre-back technically as a tackler. I think he very rarely gets dribbled past. Again, attempts a lot of tackles, so you see like a higher frequency of getting dribbled past, but not proportionally, if that makes sense. I think probably slightly underrated defensively and probably slightly overrated on the ball. I think he does a lot of the eye-catching things. He takes more risks than our other centre-backs on the ball, and when they come off, they look spectacular and can disrupt the opposition. But I think the frequency of which he does good attacking things is lower, which I know you touched on multiple times in previous episodes. Overall, I think for me, he's the best right-sided centre-back at the club. I think that's partly because I have more reservations on Robin Koch than your average fan. But I think both of them have done absolutely fine overall.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, people talk about the All Stats Aren't We position. I think we would all agree that, I think most of us would agree that Llorente should be starting at right centre back, and then, I mean, it's Llorente, then Koch, and then I think Cooper, then Strauch. I think that's, you know, there's not many people at the club who would disagree with that. And I think a lot of the disagreements over Llorente are more to do with like narratival positions rather than anything else. Like, most people aren't disagreeing that much. I think people agree that he's good on the ball. Sometimes he can be a little bit flaky defensively. And yeah, I think that's the general the general take. Darren, I'll let you push back on that.
I wasn't going to go into a long thing, but all I want to say is that the qualities that people can see in him, I can also see. I can see that he's good on the ball. I can see that he's really good at stepping out and killing opposition transitions into attack and to kind of getting in front of his man. I can see that he's very active, and therefore, so even the defensive things that he does well are quite eye-catching in ways that other players aren't. I've been, you know, really kind of clear in past episodes about some of my reservations about him, and I think that one of the things that I kind of struggle with is when the opposition are around the box and on the ball and in comfortable possession, he seems to get a bit hypnotized by the ball, and that can mean that he either loses the man or kind of loses orientation. Yeah, that's the stuff that worries me. And I know people were really excited by his involvement in our goal yesterday and everything. Frankly, I don't care whether a centre-back can do a Cruyff turn. That's not important to me, although I can see it is eye-catching and that it did help us to get up the pitch in a good way. But, you know, I think overall what I'd say is he's done well in these games recently, but I think the games that we've played recently have kind of played to his strengths. I think some of the games that we're going to see in the next three games are going to perhaps play to some of the things that I think might be his weaknesses, and I think I'd rather judge on the whole picture after that run of games or at the end of the season when you get a truer sample size and a truer kind of variation of sample before making a final judgment. But I do appreciate that he's got very, very clear qualities. It's just that I can see some things in his defending which worry me, and that's all I can really say about it.
I think in the interest of balance, it's worth saying that Liam Cooper against Manchester City, Manchester United and Liverpool worries me a little bit as well. I don't think it's not the case that, you know, we're just simply saying, well, you know, if he has three bad performances against those teams, suddenly we're gonna say that, well, yeah, here we are, we were right about him all along. I think for me, he's a very fine line defender. I think you've mentioned this, Simon, that he sort of has to do a lot defensively sometimes to make up for positional stuff. And I think that the things that worry me about those games is that you can get away with sort of jumping into challenges against Ollie McBurnie and David McGoldrick. But when you're doing that against players like Phil Foden and Raheem Sterling, you're probably not going to get away with it as much. But
I think it's a stylistic thing, what you prefer. I prefer defenders who look like they never really need to gonna make a tackle. That's just how I prefer defenders who manage to kill danger by positioning and by jockeying and moving their player into better positions. It's just a stylistic thing.
Do you want to come back on anything, Simon, that we've said?
No, I think that's all pretty fair, really. Nothing more to add.
So one final question was from James Holt-Martin, where he had talked about Robin Koch in centre midfield. Now, obviously, Robin Koch has been out because of a knee injury for a good long while, and we've seen him come back in under-23s games, and we saw him come back in the Fulham game and the game yesterday, and he was brought into central midfield. So James Holt-Martin says, yeah, could you see Robin Koch play in the midfield and Dallas going back to left-back? I'm just interested in what you guys think of the reasoning behind just bringing Koch in at centre midfield. Do you think it's simply just to break him in gently, bring him in alongside Calvin Phillips, don't have him do too much too early, rather than just sort of dumping him in the back line straight away and sort of maybe causing him problems if he's feeling a little bit tentative on his knee? But I'll go with you, Simon, first. What's your take on this? Or do you think, obviously, that we could be eventually sort of using him as a backup centre midfielder in some way?
Yeah, I mean, he played in defensive midfielder for Freiburg, but I don't see him playing many minutes in midfield for us. I think this is maybe Bielsa drinking the pragmatism Kool-Aid slightly, and it's a defensive substitution when we've been narrowly up in a game in the latter stages. I think, like we've touched on with Dallas earlier in the pod, I think the role that Dallas is playing is not your typical midfield role in a Bielsa system. I don't think you could just interchange Robin Koch in there, and so I don't see that kind of change being kind of long term.
The suggestion would be, I suppose, that if Koch were to come in that defensive midfield position, that you push Calvin up into the role that Dallas is currently doing, wouldn't I think that would be the, if there is any logic to that as an idea, that would be the logic, wouldn't it, I think?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, I watched Freiburg quite a lot. I follow them in the Bundesliga, so I watched most of his minutes last season, if not all of his minutes, and I am not a great fan of him playing in central midfield. I'll be honest, he does look like a centre-back playing as a midfielder, which, you know, maybe we have argued in the past means that he would be able to play in that defensive midfield position, but I don't think he's ever going to displace Calvin Phillips in that position. And I suspect this is more about Bielsa, like you said, drinking the pragmatism Kool-Aid and not simply just giving him an easy position to come back in, but also giving him the option to play in that position so that if he does need to play in that position, he's got experience playing in that position in the lead system. I wouldn't expect to see him playing centre midfield very often either. Probably it for me to say that I think this is what Bielsa will do, because I often think that he'll do something and then doesn't do it, or does it completely the wrong way, namely bringing him back as a centre midfielder in the under-23s game. I just thought there was no chance that was going to happen. So who knows what Bielsa's got planned, but I don't think we'll see huge amounts of minutes of him in the centre midfield space.
As much as Alioski worries me in the forthcoming games, I really don't see a good argument for taking Dallas out of the central midfield at the moment and moving him to left back. I think that would be a folly.
Agree with that, yeah.
Especially, I think, given that we're safe now.
Yeah.
I think that it's just going to be the case of, like, sucking up, getting through the last eight games with Alioski in and being like, that's fine. Well, we've arrived at the end of the podcast. Thank you so much, Simon, for coming on. Hope it wasn't too torturous for you.
No, it was great. I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks for having me on.
Mm. Yeah, hopefully we'll have you on more in the future, Darren. But yeah, thanks for coming on, I suppose.
You're always cheers,
hearing,
cheers,
hearing about me. We'll be back later this week with a Manchester City preview. Other than that, all I should say is if you do like what we do and want to get a little bit more of it, then do sign up to our Patreon, where we put video analysis and we have bonus podcasts as well. I should also say that we've got another episode of Autor's List coming up this week, I think, where we're looking at attacking midfielders, which should be fun. So that will be on Thursday at 8 p.m. That's with me, Josh Hobbs and Joe Donoghue over on our YouTube channel. But until then, all I have to do is to say thank you to Darren.
Thank you.
And thank you, Simon.
Cheers. Bye.
And we'll see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.